Good evening, everybody. Let's cultivate our motivation. Again, with a feeling of happiness that we're still alive this week. We still have our mental functions. We still have our health to whatever extent we have it. And so that gives us really the great opportunity to practice the Dharma. We don't know how long the opportunity is going to last, and we can squander it very easily following the attachment to the worldly concerns, and in the process create heaps of harmful karma that will ripen in us not having the proper circumstances for practicing. So the eight worldly concerns disturb our mind now. They create hindrances on the path later. And so let's train ourselves to look at objects of attachment as things that are like dreams, or like holograms, or like the water in a mirage, things that appear very real but are actually quite insubstantial and don't exist the way they appear. And then, giving up the eight worldly concerns, let's turn our mind towards what is of lasting benefit, full enlightenment, seeking the welfare of all living beings. And let's make that our motivation for what we do now. So you had your questions from the quiz, and I suggested that you write out, the answers just from what you could remember, and then go back over it again with your notes and with the text and see what was what. So how'd you do? What happened?
General understanding, specifics were left out.
Okay. So some general understanding, but not the specifics. Just how general? Oh, yeah, it's about the four establishments of mindfulness. Let's see. One. Okay, so let's go through it and we'll see how good your specifics are now that you had time to review them. And I'm hoping the people online, did the same. Okay, so the first question was, why are the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena selected as objects to establish mindfulness on? And what do these four establishments of mindfulness prevent the childish sentient beings from grasping? And how does preventing that lead to liberation? Okay. So, why are the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena selected as objects to establish mindfulness on?
Well, I thought is to help us loosen our clinging at self and phenomena as inherently existent. So it's actually working our grasping, our clinging to all four of those things as inherently existent, right? Sort of getting our grasping so that we can see ourselves and phenomena not as things.
Okay. Okay, so to release the grasping of inherent existence. Yeah, all four of them are designed for that. And then specifically, what are they trying to prevent the childish from clinging to or grasping at?
First, seeing the body as the I.
As the I? As the basis for the I. Okay. So what does that mean?
It's the house.
Yeah, it's like the house.
Mm.
Okay. So to stop the childish from clinging the body to be the basis of the I. And then?
And then to help the childish stop grasping at seeing the feelings as the source of enjoyment for that I.
Mm-hmm.
To loosen the grasping of the mind as the actual self,
mm-hmm.
and phenomena as the means to purify. Either the aggregates as polluting or purifying the inherently existent self. So you see the aggregates as the means to purify.
Not the aggregates, the mental factors.
The mental factors, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Mental factors.
Okay, so let's go through these again. So to prevent the childish from seeing the body as the basis of the self, so the location, the foundation of the self, the house of the self, to prevent them from clinging to feelings as the objects of enjoyment, or the objects that are experienced by that real self, to help them overcome clinging, help us overcome clinging to the mind as the actual self, or I, and to help overcome clinging to phenomena such as attachment as afflicting the person, and phenomena such as confidence or faith or wisdom as purifying the person. Okay, so they're all, but you might say, well, wait a minute, but attachment does afflict the person and faith does purify the person. But here we're talking about an inherently existent person, if we talk about it from a prasangika view. In general, the four establishments of mindfulness are taught from the view that's common to all four tenet systems, in which case the self would be, that we're negating is the self-sufficient, substantially existent self. But you can also practice them relating to the prasangika view, in which case those four are all relating to an inherently existent self. Okay. So what does it mean for the phenomena, you know, to purify or afflict the self, you know? That there's, here I am, I, me, and my attachment, you know, afflicts me and sends me to the lower realms. And my faith is going to purify me and, you know, do these wonderful things for me. Okay, so the whole thing's kind of based on this idea of this self-sufficient or inherently existent self, depending which way you're doing it. Okay? Then second question, how does the way the hearers and solitary realizers... No?
How does the...
What?
How does
how does preventing those graspings lead to liberation?
Cut the link.
Huh?
It makes it so you don't have a karma ripen that makes your next existence.
Okay, so it
it
helps to cut the link between grasping and existence, between the ninth and tenth links. Okay. How else does it help? Because that just prevents you. Yeah, that'll prevent you from being reborn in the next rebirth. How else does it help?
Realize emptiness.
Yeah. And what link is that gonna?
The first.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll help you overcome the ignorance that is the root of samsara. Okay? Okay, second question. How does the way hearers and solitary realizers meditate on the four establishments of mindfulness differ from the way that bodhisattvas meditate on them? Yeah?
Their motivation is different.
Okay.
Hearers and solitary realizers want to attain liberation, and bodhisattvas want to attain full enlightenment, mm-hmm. for the benefit of all sentient beings.
Okay, so there's a difference in the motivation, because the hearers want to attain their own liberation, and the bodhisattvas want to attain full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. Okay, so that's one way in which they're different, very pronounced way. How else?
Hearers and solitary realizers meditate on their own body, and bodhisattvas meditate on all sentient beings.
Yeah. So the hearers and bodhisattvas are going to meditate on their own body, their own feelings, okay, their own mind, their own phenomena, whereas the bodhisattvas are going to meditate on the bodies of everybody, the feelings, the mind, and so on, of everybody, in order to increase their compassion. Okay, because if you meditate on your own body as foul, that helps to generate renunciation. If then, in addition to meditating on your own body as foul, you do that for other sentient beings and see how they're trapped in these bodies, then it helps you generate much stronger compassion for other sentient beings. Okay, and so the same thing for all of these, you know. When you can see... you know, how we cling to our own feelings and make such an incredible big deal and are so reactive to feelings of happiness and misery, then we can get an idea of how other beings have that exact same thing going on in their minds, and that really helps us to be much more compassionate. Yeah, much more understanding. Okay?
Another question on that. Aren't solitary realizers and hearers also meditating on the emptiness of the self? It's not as a subtle form as the lack of inherent existence that a bodhisattva is also?
Well, according to the Prasangika, the object of negation for the hearers, the solitary realizers, and the bodhisattvas when they meditate on emptiness is the same. Okay? According to the lower schools, the object of negation is different. Okay? Because the lower schools say you can attain liberation simply by meditating on the selflessness of person, which they say is the absence of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, while the Prasangikas say, the lower schools say that liberates you from samsara, and then the Mahayana lower schools say that to attain full enlightenment, then you meditate on the selflessness of phenomena. But they have their own definitions of what constitutes the selflessness of phenomena, and that's meditated on by bodhisattvas. But according to the Prasangika, all the schools meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence of self and phenomena in order to attain liberation. Yeah. Okay, they don't. Yes? You have a problem?
Yes. The Prasangikas say that they all have the same object negation, and they just don't know it, and that's why.
No, the thing is that, you know, the way certain tenet systems lay things out, you know, they lay it out in a certain way for the benefit of people with that certain disposition. But you can be a Prasangika in terms of your view and have the motivation for your own liberation. Mm-hmm. Okay? So somebody who's like that is going to meditate on the emptiness of, of inherent existence of both self and phenomena, and they'll attain liberation. Okay, and as in the hearer vehicle or in the solitary realizer vehicle.
Okay, well, this is a longer question because I don't understand.
Okay, maybe what you're confused about is somebody can be fundamental vehicle in terms of their motivation or in terms of their tenet system. And same with being Mahayana. Okay?
Yeah, I understand that. What I don't understand is if we have four tenet systems and they identify the self and the objective be negated differently,
yes,
then how can we say ultimately they all have the same object to be negated? What's the point of having the...
Who says ultimately they all have the same object?
The present vikas say that everybody has the same object of negation.
Yes.
But if we study their tenet systems, it doesn't look like they have the same object of negation.
But see, that if you're... The hearer tenet systems... Okay, you can't say that the Vaibhasaka and Svatantrika are the hearer tenant systems.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't say that. Because you can have a Bodhisattva who is a Vaibhasaka or a Svatantrika. And you can have a hearer that's a Chittamatra or a Prasangika or a Svatantrika. See, that's the thing.
And the present geek say there's only one way, actually, to get liberated, and that is to negate. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, okay. No matter what.
Yes. Yeah. That the tenets in the other systems, okay, that don't correspond with the present geek tenets, are interpretable tenets.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
In other words, are they provisional? Provisional might be a better word. Okay? So they're provisional, given to certain people... You know, to help them along the way. Yeah. And even for the people who are, you know, who we think we're so great because we're prasangika, actually, maybe we're not even vibhasika, you know, when it comes to really what we believe. Yeah, we're not even be Buddhist, okay. We're still believing in God. Yeah, so. Okay. Yeah?
So another difference was then what they remove, which obscurations?
Well, not according to the Prasangika. According to the Prasangika, everybody who attains liberation, mm-hmm. whether they are a hearer, a solitary realizer, or a bodhisattva, they eliminate the afflictive obscurations, mm-hmm. which are the afflictions and their seeds and the karma that causes rebirth. Okay, so it's across the board.
But because the bodhisattvas go on, they also remove the karma.
Yeah, the bodhisattvas, because of the force of their bodhicitta mm-hmm. and their wish to become fully enlightened, then they use that wisdom realizing emptiness in order to cleanse the mind from all of the obscurations, including the cognitive obscurations.
Views.
The cognitive obscurations are the factor of the mind that perceives true existence or inherent existence, and the latencies of ignorance that cause that dualistic appearance. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you always in our heart. Would always see the two truths as separate.
Yeah. An arhat, when they're in meditative equipoise, see emptiness. When they're out of meditative equipoise, in post-meditation time, then they have the appearance of true existence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They don't grasp at it, mm-hmm. but they have that appearance. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's a big difference in what an arhat attains and what a Buddha attains.
It's done by the wisdom realizing emptiness, but they still they're using the same tool, but they have it's just the motivation that pushes it.
Right. It's like you could have some two people could have the same detergent, and one washes the cloth out of with one layer of dirt, and another person washes the cloth with two layers of dirt. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. Okay. So they realize, the here solitary realizes, and bodhisattvas realize the same emptiness. Mm-hmm. Yeah? The thing is that the bodhisattvas, when they meditate on emptiness, use a whole variety of reasonings to approach it, whereas the hearers and solitary realizers basically use one line of reasoning. Yeah. So the bodhisattva's mind is much more flexible, and the understanding of emptiness is richer. So we make all these divisions in the video class, but we have to see what we really are. Like you said, maybe we're not even a Buddhist yet. Okay, so what is the correspondence between the four establishments of mindfulness, okay, the four distortions, and the four noble truths? Okay.
Mindfulness of the body overcomes the distortion of seeing that which is foul as pure and relates to trudukkha.
To relates to?
True suffering, trudukkha.
Okay, why does it relate to true suffering? What's the connection? What's the connection between seeing the body as foul and understanding true sufferings?
Well, in my mind, what I have here in my notes is that His Holiness talks about the body actually being the very vehicle of suffering, being the place that it experiences it, and that grasping it is what continues and perpetuates the suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so the body is our vehicle for suffering. We grasp at it, it perpetuates our suffering. Okay. So understanding that it's foul leads to
letting go of that.
Yeah, letting go of the craving for it. In other words, renunciation. Okay. Okay.
Okay,
go on.
Mindfulness of feelings overcomes the distortion of seeing that which is in the nature of dukkha as pleasure or happiness and relates to true origin.
Okay. Now, what's the connection there between feelings, you know, and seeing them as in the nature of dukkha and the second noble truth, true origin?
Well, because by seeing that the feelings are fleeting and that they have no essential essence, we realize that grasping after them or following the graspings that they induce mm-hmm. is what leads to so much pain and suffering.
Yeah.
And so we cut
that's true, seeing that, you know, that they're impermanent and all. But here it has to do with seeing them as the nature of dukkha. So how does seeing the feelings in the nature of dukkha lead to understanding true origins?
Well, then we don't chase them. If we see that the pleasurable feelings are not pleasurable, in fact, mm-hmm. and if we see that getting away from the painful feelings also that I don't know about. But then anyway, they all boil down to the pervasive condition of being suffering all the time,
mm-hmm.
then we won't follow them. And they won't then cause us to create the afflictions that perpetuate.
How do you follow feelings?
You chase after the happiness that you think you're going to get from them.
Okay.
No?
Huh? Yeah, because the feelings induce craving.
Yeah.
Okay? And so craving is, when we talk about the second noble truth, you know, the foundation, the root is ignorance, but craving is one of the big strong things that's identified. And so when you stop seeing feelings as having the nature of being pleasurable, then you stop the craving for those feelings. So you're able to counteract true origins. Okay? Okay, then?
Mindfulness of mind overcomes the distortion that sees that which is impermanent as permanent and then leads to true cessation.
Okay, so mindfulness of the mind overcomes seeing the impermanent as permanent and relates to true cessations. How?
Yeah, this one I'm the fuzziest about, as to really the how that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Except that somewhere in my notes it says that when you start to see that the mind isn't a single solitary thing, of course, then you begin to realize that there can't be any inherently existent thing in the mind that is the person, and so you start getting interested in what is this, and really pursue the study of the nature of reality or of emptiness.
Yeah. Okay. So that's one thing about as you see the mind is impermanent, you and changing moment by moment, the mind stops appearing as one solid thing. Okay. And so that gives you some idea that, well, gee, maybe the afflictions are transient and aren't the nature of the mind, so true cessation is possible, and maybe the mind isn't a solid, inherently existent self, and so that will lead you into true cessations. Okay. Okay. So, you know, one of the things is that we cling to the mind as being the self. That's the point we just went through before. So we cling to the mind as being the personal identity. When you see that the mind isn't something solid, that it's arising and ceasing, then, you know, how can something that's arising and ceasing that quickly be this strong personal identity that we think is there? Can't be. Okay? And so seeing the absence of that strong personal identity is what is going to lead us into true cessation.
So it's recognizing that very absence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, then?
And then mindfulness of phenomena overcomes the distortion of seeing things that are selfless as having an identifiable intrinsic essence.
Mm-hmm.
And relates to two paths.
Okay, how?
Through seeing them, we know what to practice and what to abandon.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole discussion about it being from the point of view of a person that recognizes there's no inherently existent person, that's...
What do you mean?
Well, that the reason looking at them is because we grasp at them as the very thing that will ripen the inherently existent me into an inherently existent Buddha.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
So that's a different twist on how to understand that, although we haven't gotten to this section of the teaching yet, so
yeah.
I assume we'll know more.
Yeah. Yeah, but the thing is that we begin to see that none of the phenomena, for example, these different mental factors, that they also aren't the self, and that they don't afflict an inherently existent self or liberate an inherently existent self, because they themselves, you know, are essenceless. So the thing is, when you're doing these mindfulness, you know, these four establishments of mindfulness, you're really penetrating and looking very, very closely at exactly what is the body, exactly what are feelings, exactly what is the mind, exactly what are these mental factors, okay? And as you get to see these things in greater and greater levels of subtleness, yeah, then you see that there's no inherently existent self in them, and that they cannot be an inherently existent self. Okay. When you look at these things superficially, then they seem like they're either I or mine. But when you use, you know, very deep concentration to analyze and research and observe, well, exactly what are they? Yeah, you'll see that none of them are fit to be a solid self. Okay? So all the things that we thought were I and mine turn out not to be. So that shows that there's no solid I and mind at all, because you can't find it in the body or separate from the body. I mean, it's in the four, in those four, or separate from those four. Okay? Okay. So this all is very important to understand, so we understand why we're doing these meditations. Because we can sit and, let's say, do the meditation on the foulness of the body, or on, you know, how the three feelings relate to the three kinds of dukkha. But if we don't understand why we're doing it, you know, then you might have some understanding or observation of these things, but you don't know how to necessarily use it to improve the quality of your mind. And you don't understand how this all, you know, fits together to become a path to liberation. Okay? Okay. Then, name three meditations that are included in the mindfulness of the body. We talked about a few different ones.
There's the meditation that goes to the parts of the body, foulness meditation, I guess.
Okay.
The skeleton meditation and the corpse meditation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the foulness, the skeleton, the corpse. Yeah. What are you doing when, just describe those three briefly.
The foulness meditation is the sets of pentads and sestads that you just go through what's in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And skeleton meditation, visualize yourself as a skeleton, essentially. And corpse meditation, visualize other bodies or your own body as a corpse, and think about the four factors of the tactile sensation, enjoyment, the color, and the
shape.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the foulness meditation, you're looking at the different parts of the body and seeing them as disgusting, and the skeleton, seeing the body as basically a skeleton, and the corpse, seeing what is going to become of the body. So here we meditate on our own body and on other bodies, others' bodies, especially the bodies of people that we're sexually attracted to, because it really helps to cut that attachment. And that attachment is one of the chief attachments that keep us involved in cyclic existence. You know, it's one of the strongest attachments that we have. Okay? Okay, have you been doing those meditations? Yeah? Do they work? Yeah, really kind of cuts the attachment. What happens when you meditate on somebody else's body? I mean, you lose the sexual attraction. Does it give you some feeling of compassion, too? Yeah. You know, here's this person who thinks that they're a real solid person, and they're just this body, you know. I was, you know, after this whole thing that happened in Tucson the last week, it was actually, you know, quite a tragedy. And you already had people on both sides of the aisle kind of using it for political purposes and criticizing and blaming and everything like that. So there was one person who said some really, I think, pretty shocking things that I just thought, how is that person thinking correctly? I won't mention who, but maybe you can guess. and feeling, you know, quite upset, like, wow, this is somebody who, you know, aspires to lead this country, who speaks and thinks like this. And so when we were doing the, you know, our bowing last night, I visualized this person and all the other politicians doing the bowing with us. You know, because when you're doing the bowing and the purification, you have to have a mind that's humble, you know. And I was thinking, here are all these people, and they're all mouthing off and, you know, filled with themselves, filled with ambition. You know, this one person in particular, very filled with ambition, filled with just liking a lot of attention and saying these outrageous things. And yet they're still subject to aging, sickness, and death. So what is there in the world to be proud about? You know, as long as you're not immune from aging, sickness, and death, why do you think you're so great? You know? So this applies to us, and it applies to that person, but it really made me, you know, seeing all those politicians and all those people on the radio talk shows who just are like so just outlandish, you know, and they're all bowing with us, okay? They're all bowing. We all have our nose down on that floor for a long time. That was very, very helpful. Yeah? For seeing, but these are just people who, it's true, they're not beyond aging, sickness, and death. And the sad thing is that they don't see that. You know? They don't see that they're subject to aging, sickness, and death. There's no aspiration to try and get out of the situation. So the mind is just completely overtaken with, you know, what I said, ambition and arrogance and, you know, and condescension and deprecation. And, you know, so that evokes some compassion, you know, when you look at it, you know, that this person who, you know, appears on the screen, who looks, you know, so attractive and in control, it's like, you know, and arrogant, that, you know, their bodies, it's foul in nature, their feelings are, you know, all the nature of dukkha, then it's like, oh, you know, it breaks that that image of them being some kind of inherently existent person that then you can get angry at and hold disdain for. And instead it's like, oh, you know, they're just like everybody else, and the sad thing is they don't see that, and they're not doing anything to really help their situation, and so then to have compassion. Yeah. So I think that's good to think about in this time when there's so much political divisiveness and harshness, and people are on retreat. I snuck a look at the newspaper, the news online, but Obama really emphasized kind of people working together. He spoke at a memorial service yesterday and really emphasized how important it is for people to, when we talk, that we use it as a way of communicating, not a way of creating dissension. Very, very nice. Okay. Ben, fifth question. Describe the three meditations on a skeleton. Okay, so describe the steps involved in these meditations. Okay, so we can do it for ourselves. We can do it all these, you know, the whole House of Representatives. Yeah, all the, even the politicians who aren't, who don't have a government position right now, you know, everybody you know, has a skeleton inside them. Kat?
Yeah, so you start with one of them where you a small hole in the forehead and then the skin kind of peels back. And I don't know if this was in it or added to it, but the organs fall out.
Yeah.
They just kind of fall in a steaming heap on the ground. And then
no, everything dissolves.
And then there's this just this skeleton, and it starts growing and growing and fills all of space just with your bones.
Okay.
And
Yeah. Go ahead. No, I'll be
sure. And then slowly come back to regular size.
Yeah. Okay.
And then focus
Let me. That's the first step in it.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me summarize that. Okay. So the first one is you start, you know, here at the kind of your third eye area, and start dissolving the flesh, and then dissolve all the insides of the body too. And it's not that they fall on a heap; they just kind of dissolve and vanish. Yeah. So that there's only a skeleton left. And then the skeleton grows and fills the whole entire universe. You imagine the whole universe filled with bones. And that can be your object for developing concentration, okay, when you're meditating on serenity. And then afterwards, the bones come back to normal size. And then all the flesh and the skin and the organs come back, and you really contemplate what that's like. And it seems so yucky, doesn't it? Yeah. So that's the first step. Yeah, then the second step?
Yeah, well, the other variation is the organs, the skin doesn't come back on, just the pure skeleton.
Uh-huh.
Where you just are left with the skeleton and you come back to just a circle on the head. And it's just there, a bone.
Okay, that's
you concentrate
the,
on that.
Yeah, that's the well, there's the second step, okay, which is you do that whole thing with the skeleton is expanding. And then when you come back, the flesh starts reappearing and from the feet and as it goes back up. And you conclude by having all your flesh and insides back except the skull. The top of your skull. Yeah. Yeah, you focus there. His Holiness gave an alternative for that, yeah, which was then the skeleton gradually becomes smaller and it actually dissolves from the body, from the bottom up until you only have the top of the skull. Okay? So that's the second step. Then the third step. Okay.
It comes back to the point.
Yeah.
Of both of them.
Oh.
Right. Yeah, so in the third step, when it becomes smaller, then you get all the skin and flesh and your hair and everything back, except for the small area here, which remains open. Or His Holiness's variant on that is that everything dissolves except that little bit of bone that's at your midbrow. Okay, so you do those kind of one at a time. You can see that they're getting progressively more penetrating, aren't they? Okay. So how does it feel when the flesh starts reappearing?
Really creepy. Really creepy. It feels like something really, I don't know, I think of cold grease.
Yeah. Yeah. It just, yeah, just something very creepy, something very disgusting. Yeah.
And it's very, I was very puzzled that and surprised that meditating on the skeleton was so peaceful and so calming somehow.
Yes.
Not at all what I expected.
Yeah. Okay.
It seemed like it would be the opposite, like thinking of skeletons going to be creepy and your own body's going to be fine, but they're flipped somehow.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember when I was, you know, explaining this and you were going, ooh, I don't want to meditate on a skeleton. But here you're saying that you did and your experience was the opposite of what you thought it was going to be, that actually your mind became very peaceful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's something, I think, that's so simple and stark about the bones. Yeah, they're just bones. Yeah, nothing fancy on them. Yeah. But it's interesting how you can think that the meditation is going to have one effect and it has another. I actually find meditating on, you know, when we go through the 32 or 36 parts of the body, I find that also makes my body, my mind very calm. Very calm. You know, it's
sober.
Like...
Huh? Sober in a way that was nice.
Right. Yeah, it makes the mind very sober. And it stops all the, you know, kind of chattering and, you know, you stop caring about what people think of you. Yeah, you stop worrying about how you look. You don't worry about if you're going to get this promotion or this or that, because you're focused just on really what the nature of the body is. So the mind becomes very sober, very calm, because all that kind of chatter, a lot of it, which is related to the eight worldly concerns, is stilled. Okay. Then, why do we do meditations on the foulness of the body, and what is a healthy relationship to have with our body? So, yeah?
The meditations are antidotes to desire and helps one to develop renunciation.
Mm-hmm.
And a healthy relationship to the body is to keep it healthy so that we can study and practice the Dharma.
Okay, so the purpose of the foulness of the body is to develop renunciation and to let go of attachment to the body, and then a healthy relationship with our body is to take care of it, not with the thought of, oh, but I don't want to experience pain in my precious body and like this, but just so that we can use it to practice the Dharma. So how successful are you on having a good relationship with your body?
Oh.
Yeah? There's some reaction happening. What's your relationship with your body?
I think it's quite distorted. I mean, these meditations are very helpful, but in terms of, partly it also has to do with this, with looking at the senses, so that it's a little bit confused, but... You know, like always thinking I'm too fat, or then worrying if I'm maybe not doing this or that. I mean, there's always this kind of constant judgment about the body going on in the mind.
Mm.
It's kind of there all the time, mm-hmm. in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like I'm obsessing about it, but there is some aspect of it that's always there.
Okay. So the mind continually is saying, am I too fat? Am I too thin? How do I look? You know, do I look as old as I feel? You know, do I look as young as I feel? Oh, yeah, all these age spots. Oh, what about the varicose veins? They're coming now. And, you know, are my glasses kind of, do they make me look good? And, you know, there's always that kind of thing going on. What other kind of thing is going on?
Mine is more like the two digits of... I kind of fall in the ditch of taking too much care, like being really careful, seeking comfort,
uh-huh.
and then kind of ignoring my body and making it do things and then having to kind of pay up.
Mm.
Okay. So going those two extremes.
Okay, so you find that yours is a little bit different,
yeah.
and your unhealthy relationship with the body is either pushing it to do things it can't do because you're ignoring it, or falling to the side of self-indulgence where you start worrying about every tiny thing that happens.
Right.
Yeah, and just want it to cover, to be comfortable. And so you go back and forth between those two. And the mind doesn't have any peace, does it? Yeah, does the mind have peace? No? Okay. Other people? Yeah?
I... do a lot of comparing about what my body used to be able to do, and now the aging of it seems like on a daily basis my level of capacity is declining, and then the mind that gets anxious about that and fearful about that, and then worries about it's downhill from here, and just the comparison of past, mm-hmm. present, and then the fear of the future.
Okay, so the. What you find your unhealthy way of relating the body is comparing the the past of the body to your present ability and seeing that you can't do now what you used to be able to do. And then from there going, well, what's going to happen in the future? And then that leads to a lot of worry and anxiety.
Just the words, decrepit.
Yeah. So what ideas do you have? What can you do to make your relationship with your body healthier?
Well, actually doing these meditations is quite helpful in terms of what is it for, this body? Mm-hmm. What is it useful for? Mm-hmm. You know, and really looking at it as its value being the foundation for practice, then the rest of that is irrelevant.
Okay.
So it does help.
Okay. So when you do these meditations, it's been quite helpful because it shows you that looking after whether your body is attractive or not doesn't really matter because it's all this gunk. And the real purpose of the body is to use it for practice. And so that helps you then keep reminding yourself on a daily life basis, okay, I got to keep my body healthy in order to practice.
Especially thinking of it as a substantial cause for the course.
Okay, so thinking of it as the substantial cause for the course really cuts the attachment to how you look. Yeah? Yeah. It's very helpful, you know? It's like, I mean, I was thinking about this too, about, you know, what just happened in Tucson, and all these memorials and people praising all the people who are dead. And the people who are dead are not around to enjoy everybody making such a big deal about them. You know? Kind of what you've wanted your whole life is for everybody to pay attention to you and make a big deal about you, and now they are, and you're not even here. Yeah? But it really, you know, again, makes us focus on, well, what really is important in all of this? Yeah, reputation's not important. The attractiveness of our body isn't important. Yeah, the long term, using the body as a vehicle for practice is. And how...
Well, I think
what can
I've
you do?
Been more on the question of meditating on this in a way. When I'm doing a task or something, I've noticed what I do is measure to the task, not how I'm feeling doing. And I try to get more like, okay, here I am shoveling, that's great. But instead of having it be, I'm going to shovel to there no matter how I feel, just how am I doing right now? How am I doing right now? How am I doing right now? And that's been very helpful, realistic. Like, okay, it's time to stop. I'm not at the end of the path, or I haven't done an hour. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah. So you're finding that just monitoring yourself and paying attention to your body is good. Instead of thinking, having a goal set beforehand about how much you're going to do, you monitor your body as you're doing it. And when your body's tired, you stop. And that might be before you do what you thought you were going to do. Or you might do what you thought you were going to do and still have energy and be able to do more.
Yeah, and both have happened.
Yeah.
So it's been very interesting.
Okay. But both of these have happened. Okay. Do you think these meditations could help?
On the Christian ones?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure they are. You know, because I'm just more conscious of what it is that's here. You know, rather than all of my proliferation about it.
Okay. So the meditations are helping you actually pick up on what's going on inside your body.
Yeah.
Instead of having some kind of just having a conceptual view of our body that we relate to.
Right.
Yeah. And so therefore being able to monitor what you can do and what you can.
Well, the body of the past is gone.
The body of the past is gone, right.
The body of the future has yet to appear.
The body of the future has yet to appear.
And the body of the present, changing moment by moment, is just doing fine. I mean, it's is being able to be kind, is helping the mind to practice, is taking care of other beings, it's doing what it needs to do, and it's. Mm-hmm. But part, so much that I'm realizing is that because I've spent so much of my life really working with my body and how strong it was, there was so much identity to it. Mm-hmm. So now the identity is changing, and I've got a misconception about what that identity is, and disappointed on what it's being labeled on, you know. And so looking at how much I've identified to my body is this
Okay, so what you're doing to avoid comparing your body to the past and feeling sad and then projecting in the future to becoming decrepit is to stay right in the moment. Because the past is over, the future hasn't come. And you're also watching how your feeling of who you are changes with what your body is. Yeah. And that leads into what I call aging gracefully. It's like, you know, one day I'm going to look like that. If I'm alive that long, I mean, I'm just going to be completely wizened and whatever it is. But can I have a sense of humor about that? Can I still have a sense of purpose in my life, even though when my body is like that? You know, why do I base my whole feeling about life about in terms of what my body can and can't do? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Because we could be very old and falling apart physically, but if our mind is intact, we can still do a lot of quite wonderful things.
And for me, sometimes even looking at the fact that my mind is still very strong, I'm practicing building the capacity of my mind to be able to practice and integrate the Dharma. So for me, if there's a trade-off on whether I'm going to have a strong mind or a strong body at the time of death, I definitely want the strong mind.
Yes.
So okay. I'm going for the trade-off here.
Yeah, yeah. So you're seeing that although your body's declining with time, your mind is actually getting stronger. And that's what you want. And that's what's going to benefit you at the time of death.
To comment online, observing all sorts of shapes and sizes of bodies and borders in a locker room really reduces attention to the bodies.
Oh, yeah. So observing all kinds of shapes and sizes and odors of bodies in a locker room really reduces the attachment. Very definitely. Yeah. Very definitely. Okay. Oh, it's time to stop. Mm. Okay, so we did, what did we do? We did
six.
Okay, so we'll start with number 7 next week. And it's still online for the people, so the people can look online and get the questions. And then fill them out without looking at your notes, just to see what you can remember. Then fill them out with, you know, go back and review them with your notes. Okay? Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Guru Ratnamam Delakam Niryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Oryatara, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, cheer the source of good and happiness. Powerful tenting Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Forest.